Trump administration is ramping up its feud with sanctuary cities by deploying Border Patrol agents to them.
They're going to be conducting routine immigration arrests, and that might mean that they will start showing up at businesses and homes trying to track down unauthorized immigrants.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 17th, we'll take a look at the impacts this will have. Plus, construction of the southern border wall seems to be destroying Native American burial sites and other sacred lands.
For indigenous peoples, the border is increasingly a symbol of genocide.
And we talk workers' rights for strippers, one of the most vulnerable workforces.
They keep the contracts. They don't let you photograph them. You can sneak a photo, but they don't want you looking at the contract you're signing, never mind having a copy of it, because they're heinous.
Lots to get to. Let's get going. The Trump administration's battle against sanctuary cities wages on. As first reported by the New York Times, Customs and Border Protection will be deploying dozens of border agents over the coming months to 9 sanctuary cities, including L.A., Houston, and Newark, New Jersey. These are cities that limit their cooperation with federal immigration enforcement agents in order to protect nonviolent immigrants from deportation. Part of this deployment will include an elite SWAT-like Border Patrol team called BORTAC. They'll assist ICE agents in their ongoing efforts to deport undocumented immigrants. This move is just the latest by the administration to crack down on so-called sanctuary cities, which have been trying to limit federal immigration enforcement efforts since Trump first took office. For more on this, we're joined by Nicole Narea, immigration reporter for Vox. Nicole, hi.
Thanks for having me, Arun.
To start, what can you tell us about BORTAC and how its agents operate?
So, yeah, it's basically Border Patrol's version of a SWAT team. They're heavily armed and they undergo grueling special training for high-risk law enforcement activities. And those can include sniper certification and heavy weapons training. They're stationed primarily on the U.S.-Mexico border, where their responsibilities have included raiding, for example, stash houses and tracking down drug smugglers and human traffickers. And those kinds of activities can often turn violent. You might remember the image of Elian Gonzalez in the year 2000, the Cuban boy who was caught in the middle of an international controversy after he was rescued from a boat full of asylum seekers trying to reach Florida. BORTAC agents broke into his uncle's house at one point, and there's now a famous photo of them pointing their guns at the crying child.
That's right. So it's been quite a while since that kind of iconic image, resonated across headlines and newspapers. And now they're sort of back in a big way, I guess. Is it clear, I guess, how much of an impact they can have in cities like L.A. or Newark, New Jersey?
So DHS has specified that it's not only BORTAC agents that are going to be deployed to these cities, but just the fact that they will be among the forces that are deployed to these cities is pretty striking. They're going to be conducting routine immigration arrests, and that might mean that they will start showing up at businesses and homes trying to track down unauthorized immigrants.
And so what kind of timeline are we talking about? This is a sort of a short-term project, if you will, correct?
Yes, it's going from February through May.
So do you have a sense of whether this is more of a symbolic show or if this can actually sort of change enforcement and potentially removals from these cities?
So the administration says that the deployment of these extra officers is meant to support ICE with a goal of increasing arrests by 35%. That's something that concerns Democrats, who have said that setting these kinds of arbitrary benchmarks will encourage ICE to basically just deport as many people as possible and to treat them inhumanely. But more than that, it really is just to serve to intimidate immigrant communities. The message that the Trump administration is sending is that if you're an unauthorized immigrant, there's no place that's safe, including a sanctuary city. But it's not really clear at this point whether we'll actually see BORTAC agents kicking down doors or something like that. But just the fact that news stories have featured photos of officers carrying these heavy guns has kind of done the administration's job for them in terms of helping conjure this image of what could happen.
Where are these agents being deployed from?
So most of them are stationed on the U.S.-Mexico border at the moment, helping with counter-narcotics and anti-gang activity.
Right. So is it clear how this will affect the border if they're being taken away from border activities?
Yeah. I mean, a big problem with the fact that Trump has been cracking down on unauthorized immigrants who may not pose an immediate threat to public safety is that there's been such a loss to these other programs that are trying to counter legitimate threats on the border. So there's no really telling or a way to quantify what kind of crimes that are being committed on the border will go unprosecuted.
Is it clear that the federal government has the authority to do this?
So under CBP regulations, the agency has pretty broad powers to operate within 100 miles of any U.S. external boundary. And that includes all of the sanctuary cities where these additional forces will deploy. But that said, they can't just start pulling anyone over unless they have reasonable suspicion that they've committed an immigration violation or crime, and they can't search vehicles without a warrant or probable cause. So there are some limits on CBP's authority in terms of that. And because BORTAC is part of CBP, they would presumably have the same authority. That said, a few prominent Democrats, including Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, said last week that the Trump administration not only lacked justification for escalating immigration enforcement in this way, but they also didn't have Congress's consent to use BORTAC in this way when they're supposed to be addressing high-risk threats.
Now, periodically, we hear about these heightened enforcement efforts happening in different cities. How successful have those attempts been?
You hear about these sweeps happening. There are some prominent ones in Michigan where hundreds of people were arrested. And Trump has threatened to do these wide-scale sweeps and deport millions of undocumented immigrants. The thing is, in practice, the immigration agencies just don't have the resources to carry out those kinds of enforcement actions, but they really do make an example of immigrants who are in the country without documents. So that has the purpose of sort of intimidating other people into either leaving or going deeper into the shadows and not coming forward.
And when it comes to cities like LA, like Houston, the cities that are being targeted with this particular effort, is it likely that they will counter this move by somehow either undermining these efforts on the part of the Trump administration or just simply going to court?
There's a number of ways that they could probably deal with this. Going to court is one option. It's not clear exactly what the legal arguments would be at this point, but they could argue that this is really undermining the purpose of their sanctuary policies. They don't want unauthorized immigrants to be afraid of reporting crimes, for example, and assisting police investigations, because that makes the general public, including the immigrants' U.S. citizen children, less safe. They want them to be able to seek out help. And if this ends up resulting in some sort of excessive use of force against immigrant communities, that could also be a reason to challenge the policy. You know, BORTAC officers don't usually engage in community-based law enforcement. So it could, some Democrats have said, lead to unnecessary injuries or even casualties. So this could have some pretty large ramifications.
It probably bears, revisiting this term sanctuary cities. I think for some people, these are places where violent criminals are just kind of let loose after being briefly sort of detained by local police. But that doesn't quite represent the actual reality of what happens in these cities, correct?
No. And in fact, research has shown that sanctuary policies don't appear to make a city more dangerous. There's a limited body of research on this at this point, but studies have found either that sanctuary policies either result in a slight decrease in crime rates or that they have no effect. For example, one study published in the Journal of Urban Affairs Review in 2017 compared crime rates both before and after sanctuary cities passed their laws and found that there was no statistically discernible difference in the rates of violent crime, rape, and property crime. So it's sort of the fact that Trump is trying to portray sanctuary cities as crime-ridden and putting the public in danger just isn't really panning out in the research.
So when the administration says at times like this that these cities have allowed criminals to hit the streets and that they're not cooperating with federal officials, is that term criminals meant simply to refer to the fact that they're here undocumented rather than to the fact that they are, you know, committing felonies?
I mean, certainly that's the way that the administration sees it. In previous administrations, we haven't been prosecuting people in a criminal context for immigration violations or for crossing the border without authorization. So, Yeah, that is the way that the Trump administration sees it. But they're also picking out these individual instances of immigrants that have committed violent crimes and trying to play those up in the national media in order to make the case that sanctuary cities are, in fact, a threat to public safety. But, you know, on the individual level, sure, people commit crimes, but overall, that's just not what the data is showing.
And most of the cities that are being targeted by the administration do have large immigrant communities. Have we seen ways in which they've adapted to this climate 3 years into the Trump era?
Absolutely. We saw, for example, a few years ago, the mayor of Oakland, California, sanctuary city, notified the public when there was a major ICE sweep that was anticipated. And legal aid groups have long been trying to educate unauthorized immigrants living in the U.S. on their rights when they come into contact with immigration agents. So, for example, they have rights not to answer questions about their immigration status, and they don't have to consent to be searched if they're not arriving at a port of entry, if it's just an encounter with an ICE agent on the streets. So there are ways that they have tried to educate the public and protect them from federal immigration enforcement.
You've also heard about phone trees happening within certain communities where people call each other and say, don't head outside. You know, you might be vulnerable right now. It's not safe. But is it clear whether those kinds of tactics would work given the deployment of BORTAC and the like?
I mean, it's hard to say. If BORTAC starts using violent displays of force against immigrant communities, then I don't know that phone trees are going to be a sufficient protection for these communities. But I think the best sort of advice is, you know, don't open your door when a CBP agent comes knocking, because you just don't know what you're sort of letting into your home. And I think that that's what a lot of public officials have been trying to tell their constituencies.
The Justice Department also recently mounted legal challenges against several states and local governments because of their sanctuary policies. Does the Justice Department have a case?
The Justice Department has been trying to attack these sanctuary policies for a long time. They lost in California, so I'm not sure that they'll be able to prevail in New Jersey and Washington on the same grounds. But, you know, states have been prevailing so far in terms of being able to protect their right not to cooperate with federal immigration agents. And even though the administration has pretty sweeping powers to carry out enforcement actions in communities, there's not really any law at this point saying that local communities need to cooperate in that effort.
Nicole, we do have to leave soon, but is it clear that the president is really taking a very active hand in ramping up this against sanctuary cities?
Yes. I mean, he's been railing against sanctuary cities ever since he was on the campaign trail. And while his primary focus has been on the southern border, he's trying to ramp it up in an election year against immigrants in the interior of the U.S. And that's really just to appeal to his base in suggesting that immigrants are dangerous.
Nicole Narea is an immigration reporter for Vox. Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, the Pentagon announced it's transferring $3.8 billion from various weapons programs to pay for President Trump's border wall. Meanwhile, construction for that wall in Arizona is damaging sacred Native American burial sites in a UNESCO ecological preserve. Poet Natalie Diaz was recently in Arizona and witnessed the construction firsthand.
For me, as an indigenous person, the wall represents America at its fruition, like America is finally full-fledged, arrived at itself, but it also represents what America has been since its beginning. For all of its claims of respecting life, it has no respect for life. It has no forethought. It doesn't understand anything beyond its own appetite.
But the border wall construction continues to affect communities far beyond this particular site. There are tens of thousands of people belonging to Native tribes that straddle the border with Mexico, and who frequently cross for school, work, or to visit family. Many in the communities worry that continuing with the wall construction may bar them from accessing these cross-border resources, many of which are granted by international agreements, including from the United Nations. Joining us today is Yaqui Chicana scholar Cristina Leza, professor of anthropology at Colorado College. Cristina, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, thank you for having me.
How is construction of the wall affecting indigenous communities that live nearby?
It depends on the community and where they're located on the U.S.-Mexico border. There are some communities which are being impacted very directly on their reservation lands. The Tona'atham Nation, for example, you have had for many years border wall, border barrier construction happening directly on territories occupied by community members on the reservation. In communities like the Kumeyaay Nation in California, you have construction happening in sacred areas, such as a sacred mountain there. Also along the border, you have construction happening that is impacting sacred territories, burial sites of various indigenous nations. So although you don't see construction happening necessarily in home communities, you still see the disturbance of ancestral lands by that border wall construction.
I think for a lot of people, the border is a very particular sort of, I guess, symbol and tool. What does it mean to you?
To me, it means, I think traditionally, separation of people's a way of claiming ownership of territories in ways that, to echo Natalie Diaz, very much go back to the beginnings of the United States as a nation, attempting to disregard the presence of the first peoples of these territories and to establish a claim over these territories. And for indigenous peoples, the border is increasingly a symbol of genocide, as I think that we see in the beginnings, this attempt to eliminate indigenous peoples, eliminate traces of indigenous peoples in terms of their own claims over these territories as their homelands.
And how are these tribes resisting the building of the wall?
You do see tribal nations becoming increasingly vocal about border wall construction and the negative impacts of that construction on indigenous nations. The Tona'atham Nation in particular has been very vocal about their opposition to the border wall. The Yaqui Nation as well in Arizona has joined the Tona'atham in vocalizing their concern about border wall construction and border enforcement in general. You do see nations like the Tona'atham Nation and the Yaqui Nation working to find solutions to these problems. In January of last year, there was a border summit that took place in Tucson, Arizona, that was organized by the Tona'atham Nation and the Yaqui Nation, together with the NCAI, the National Congress of American Indians, to try to work with other nations along the U.S.-Mexico border to develop policies that would help to secure the rights of indigenous peoples along the U.S.-Mexico border. And then on the grassroots level, you see protest action occurring. Various groups have definitely been very active, both on the ground along the U.S.-Mexico border, as well as active on social media.
So clearly very powerful interests in support of construction of a wall, beginning with the president at the top. But what kind of allies do these nations have?
In terms of allies, there are certainly political representatives who are working with indigenous nations or trying to help indigenous nations voice their rights along the U.S.-Mexico border. Representative Rahul Grijalva, for example, has been very vocal in his opposition and has tried to relay the concerns of indigenous peoples. There are definitely, again, at the grassroots level, various allies in the Southwest, activists who have been vocal about their concerns and also attempted to help represent indigenous concerns along the U.S.-Mexico border.
I think for people who don't live near the border, it may be difficult to sort of picture some of these spaces and the ways in which people who are Native American kind of come and go. Can you give us a sense of what it looks like to someone who may be able to, you know, cross the international border?
Sure. And again, this depends on the nation. So, for example, on the Tana'atham Nation, it has become increasingly difficult for individuals to cross the U.S.-Mexico border through the traditional routes of the nation. There are traditional routes that people have followed originally by foot and then by vehicle. But because of border barrier construction, it's become increasingly difficult to be able to travel along those routes. In addition to barrier construction, there's also been difficulty for members of the Tana'atham Nation in terms of simply being able to cross their traditional lands for the gathering of medicinal plants, for purposes of walking along traditional routes, for ceremonial purposes, because of the constant presence of Border Patrol and the suspicion of Border Patrol agents who see individuals, in particular brown-skinned individuals, roaming those areas along the U.S.-Mexico border. And there have been reports from citizens of the Tana'atham Nation about harassment, feelings of intimidation when being approached by Border Patrol agents.
Christina Leza is a professor of anthropology at Colorado College. Thanks so much for joining us, Christina.
Yes, thank you.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega. Good to have you with us. And another story for you today. Recently, a viral video emerged of Janae Sky, a woman in Dallas who works as a stripper and who fell from a 15-foot pole. Remarkably, she kept dancing after her fall and later posted a video on Instagram where she revealed she had suffered extensive injuries from the accident.
I pretty much broke my jaw and I have to have surgery on it tomorrow. I broke some teeth. I got a sprained ankle.
She started a GoFundMe page to help pay for medical costs because she, like nearly all strippers, is an independent contractor and not an employee of the club where she performs. This story has brought to light safety issues that strippers face on a daily basis and why the business can be so exploitative for dancers. Let's talk about it. I'm joined by Jacqueline Francis, aka Jack the Stripper, a stripper, an artist, and author who also consulted on the movie Hustlers. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Jack.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line, we have A.M. Davies, coordinator of Soldiers of Pole, an advocacy organization for strippers in California. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me as well.
A.M., the injuries that Janae Sky faced seem extreme, but is this an industry where physical injuries are common?
Well, physical injuries in such an extreme manner aren't as common, or physical injuries that happen in such a fast moment aren't as common. It's more of long-term injuries that are actually the most common and are prevalent in the industry. We use our bodies constantly for a really long period of time, and so you're more likely to see chronic injuries over time, as opposed to what happened with Janae was it does happen, but it's not something that happens to that extreme often.
So even just the simple act of dancing in high heels for hours on a daily basis must have serious long-term effects, right?
Absolutely, it does, yes.
Jack, Eric Langan, who is the club owner, told TMZ that this was just an accident and that he has no plans to remove the pole. What do you think of his response?
Well, I don't know that it's necessary to remove the pole. I don't know if that's enough of a response. So I think that club owners should be more gracious and appreciative of the people who pay their mortgages. If there's no strippers in your club and no entertainers, you're just a bar and no one's going to show up. So I think people should, just be a little bit more thoughtful. And if you're going to classify us as independent contractors, honor that. It's not honored. And where we see employee status, it's also kind of exploitative too. AM is working on that with Soldiers of Pole, but There's so much that can be done, and dialogue with club owners would be great, because it's great that they actually responded to TMZ, but club owners don't tend to respond to any grievances by dancers.
So when you say honor that, what does that mean in this context?
Holding up your end of the contract. You know that I've been a dancer for 10 years, and I've worked with maybe 20, 25 clubs, and I have ever been able to take home a contract one time. They keep the contracts. They don't let you photograph them. You can sneak a photo, but they don't want you looking at the contract you're signing, never mind having a copy of it, because they're heinous.
does acting as an independent contractor, is that something a lot of dancers prefer?
That's a good question. Everyone has a different idea of what they want. I think AM can really speak to what's happening in California, because there's been a recent shift and people have more strong opinions about what they want. I have never been an employee as a stripper. I've always been an independent contractor. It hasn't been great, but it's just what it has been.
Yeah, absolutely. The fact of the matter is that every stripper across the United States technically is an employee. We're being misclassified, and we're being illegally misclassified, which is why they don't want us to see the contracts. They don't want lawyers looking at our contracts. And in some cases in the clubs here, if you're asking to see a contract or have a lawyer look at it, you'll be asked to go home. So it's either sign this contract or don't work. As far as dancers wanting to be an independent contractor versus an employee, there's so many misconceptions around that concept. So it's really difficult to even get a proper consensus, because most dancers don't even know really what the true difference is, because they've been getting lied to by club owners and managers for decades now. And so because the waters are so muddy, that's a really difficult question to properly answer, because there needs to be more education around the subject.
When you said that so many dancers are misclassified, can you walk us through the distinction?
Yeah, absolutely. So as an independent contractor, you're supposed to set your own hours. You come and go as you please. You bring your own tools. As an independent contractor, you're not the sole purpose of that business. So the reason why dancers are being classified as employees is because, as part of the law, whatever the workers are doing that makes the business what it is, then they should be classified as employees. And since, like Jacqueline said, without the strippers, you have no strip club, well, then they definitely should be classified as employees. And as employees, they get more rights, they get benefits to help with things like what we were talking about with chronic injuries. You get disability, you get workers' compensation when you fall 15 feet off of a pole. As an independent contractor, you get absolutely none of those benefits, and you get absolutely no rights. You can't negotiate any of your terms. You can't even talk about any of your grievances on the job as an independent contractor.
Now, when we see, I guess, legal fights happening in other areas, say with rideshare industry, in terms of this conversation about who is a contractor and who's an employee, are these things sort of moving this ball forward when it comes to strippers as well?
So if you're speaking specifically about the AB 5 bill that was passed, yes, that directly affects strippers and a lot of gig workers here in California, including translators. And so in the media, everyone's talking about Uber and Lyft because that's what we all use on a regular basis. But the translator industry and the strip club industry is being greatly affected by the new laws that have been passed here. You know, the way the dancers are being treated now is like you make a schedule and you adhere to that schedule. And if you don't show up or you call out, they're getting punished, they're getting charged late fees. And that's just not something that happens to an independent contractor. So even though they're misclassifying the dancers, they're still violating independent contractor, like, typical agreements.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that in New York City, as an independent contractor, we are told to work for 8 hours minimum, to stay at the club for 8 hours. It's really hard to sparkle and be engaging and interested in people and to look hot for 8 hours in 7-inch shoes while everyone's power drinking. It's really challenging. It's really hard work, and we need to just be more respectful of the people who are doing this work. Everybody has to work, and judging people for the kind of work they do is classist, and you should really check that. If that's what you're focused on is the kind of work she's doing rather than the injuries that she's sustained from this, like, extraordinary fall, because she's really talented and an incredible performer. She takes huge risks. We're not saying this about when something happens at Cirque du Soleil. We need to be more respectful and cool about how other people are surviving under capitalism, because we all know that it's not easy.
Jack, when we see the response to this incident with Janae Sky, a lot of dismissive sort of responses on social media, certainly a lot of misogynistic ones. You can't really remove gender, obviously, from this is not simply a labor issue. This has very much to do with women in an industry where they're not necessarily in control of the terms of their contracts, right?
I mean, women are in control of their own body. Like, stripping is great because when I first started, I was like, this is my body. This is all of I need. Stripping is the most ethical kind of work I've ever done, okay? I show up, the less clothing, the less things I have on my body, the better. There's no waste. There's no takeout container from getting a lap dance, you know? And the work is just terrifying to people that women could possibly survive by just existing and charging for their time and their energy and their sparkle and their sensuality. And it makes people so uncomfortable and so furious. But really, if it's not your body, it's not your business. If you're not paying for her labor, if you're not paying for that lap dance and you're not giving that lap dance, what is it to you? Why does that matter? So I think that we should really just honor the fact that these women are athletes and working extraordinarily hard and huge risks.
A.M. Davies is coordinator of Soldiers of Pole, an advocacy organization for strippers in California, and Jacqueline Francis, a.k.a. Jack the Stripper, who is a stripper, an artist, and author, and consulted on the recent movie Hustlers. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and this is The Takeaway.